Hello and welcome to Outward, the queerest podcast in all the land. I'm Brian Lauder, an editor at Slate, and today we are continuing our conversation with Chase Strangio, trans rights advocate and lawyer with the ACLU. If you haven't listened to last week's episode with Chase, please do. Jules and I really, really loved having that conversation, and Chase just did an incredible job, honestly, breaking down the current rash of anti-trans laws and bills, taking us inside what he's thinking about them as a lawyer and as a trans human being, of course, and letting us know what to watch for legally this year. But we also talked to Chase about the pitfalls of visibility and how to go about building coalitions and true solidarity outside the courtroom. And that's the part of the discussion you're going to hear today. In mid-February, Chase published an op-ed in the New York Times titled, "Trans Visibility is Nice, Safety is Even Better." It's such a great title and such an important piece. This idea of whether visibility is good or bad, helpful or harmful, is something that all oppressed minority groups have to wrestle with. But it can feel especially pressing or even maybe really confusing for trans people right now. In fact, let me just read you a little excerpt from this op-ed that gets into these issues. This is Chase. "In the past several years, popular culture in Hollywood and publishing has begun to elevate and even celebrate trans characters. That's a welcome change. And yet, while we can finally, at least on occasion, see or read accurate stories of our lives, this rise of visibility has coincided with, and perhaps even precipitated, a widespread political assault on trans people across the country. This duality felt particularly stark at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah last month, where the comedian Will Ferrell and his longtime friend, the former Saturday Night Live writer Harper Steele, premiered their film Will and Harper on the same day that the Utah legislature voted on a sweeping bill curtailing the rights of trans people. The film documents the pair's 17-day road trip from New York to California, which gave Mr. Ferrell a chance to learn about Mrs. Steele's experience as a transgender woman and her decision to come out and live openly as herself at age 59. The Park City audience gave the film multiple standing ovations, but little attention was paid to efforts to criminalize the presence of trans people in public spaces, including their use of bathrooms and locker rooms, happening just 45 minutes away in Salt Lake City. Indeed, the very premise of the film, traveling across the country, could very well soon switch from comedy to terror, as lawmakers across the United States continue to aggressively train their attention on the bodies of trans people of all ages." So again, that's part of Chase's op-ed in the Times. Definitely go read the whole thing. We're going to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, you'll hear Jules and me continue our conversation with Chase Strangio. And we'll start by talking about that op-ed. All right, welcome back to Outward. I'm Brian Lauder, and Jules Gill-Peterson and I are talking to trans activist and ACLU lawyer Chase Strangio. I think a lot of listeners would think of media visibility of the kind that you wrote about in your op-ed, Chase, being this place where work was being done, progress was being made, right? And you point out, I think really importantly, that like maybe not, maybe visibility is a trap, right? Like in that Foucault saying, like, and we've got all of this backlash, I guess, happening at the same time alongside that visibility. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant in that argument in the op-ed? Because I thought it was so telling and clarifying.
I feel very conflicted about it.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I think as I was someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, desperate for some understanding of myself. Like there was no, like life was much harder because I was so lost. And part of why I was lost is because I could not see anything that looked like whatever I felt like inside, which I still don't, you know, I don't know, because it was such a feeling of lostness. So I recognize that finding ourselves does require us often to find others, and that this is a critical part of survival for so many people, and I would say myself included. The problem is we are hyper-visible right. to the people who want to harm us. Mm-hmm. This idea that there's a lack of trans visibility is, I think, it is sort of like the false premise, because ultimately, if you're visible, hyper visible, in fact, and sort of completely contorted in that construction, then and there's no material structures of support, then your visibility is just constantly the mechanism through which the violence against you is reinforced, whether that's interpersonal violence or structural violence or, you know, all of the forms of violence that trans people experience, compounding, you know, all the other forms of violence that our legal system, you know, necessitates. So I think that, and in, you know, the in this moment that we're in, and the way media and the production of images and discourse occurs, then there's also just, it can become an end in of itself, and it's just like its own distracting cycle of goals. And I what I see right now is like a desperate need for, you know, sort of like invisible networks of care, going back into like, you know, the distribution of hormones to people, to finding your people and taking care of them in smaller networks, totally not glorious in its, you know, nature. And rather than the big Supreme Court win, what we need to do is sort of maneuver the pieces of the regulatory state in our benefit, which we were doing all for, by the way, for a long time. Like, I'm 41 and I'll talk to people now and they're like, well, what? I can't imagine what would happen if Medicaid excluded this coverage in a big state. And I was like, well, guess what? Every person under, like, I don't know, like every person over 30 lived that reality. I mean, this is not hypothetical. Like, we all maneuvered through insurance denials and Medicaid exclusions and police surveillance, and we have that information, and we get distracted by the idea that if we become the visible messenger, or we become the person on television, or we have the big win, that that's going to create this safety. And it's not, because that's just going to create more harms unless we do a lot more change. And so I really worry about where we are, and there's just like a fundamental lack of understanding about how these systems are working against us, in part because of our, you know, complete lack of understanding of civics, and also because of our complete disconnect from our history. Even that people are like, what would happen if insurance denied this? And I was like, what would happen? Talk to 10 people in this room. and so, like, why are we so disconnected from our lineages, I think is gravely concerning, and just says to me that we're focused on the wrong places.
Woo. I might have to restrain myself because I'm so violently disagreeing. Excuse me, I'm so violently agreeing with you, Chase. I'm so used to saying that. Violently. I disagree with people. It's actually very. Yeah, sorry, but because I'm a historian, I'm always just like, sitting here knowing too much about how we got into these messes. But I think this is a really important point to follow through. Maybe this, you know, can kind of bring us towards to the end of our conversation. And this is me speaking here. I'm not going to put words in anyone's mouths. But in my professional opinion, you know, a lot of people have been caught with their pants down in recent years. LGBT advocacy organizations that have been fighting for very narrow legal victories, and deprioritizing the needs, especially of poor trans women and of sex workers. You know, I think also like medicine itself, you know, it's just like psychiatrists are not friends of trans people, in my learned opinion, and they will fail to defend our interests in the court of public opinion or, you know, in the political arena. I think what we're facing is a political struggle through and through. And I really appreciate you, Chase, really stressing, right, what law can and can't do. It's not that it's not important to litigate these battles, because real harm, right, is being inflicted on people. I think to a degree that is almost so astonishing to comprehend that I understandably, I think most people don't even want to think about it, but it's already happening. The harms have already happened, right? It could get worse, but the law is not going to be the source of transformational justice. It never has been. and so it never can be. It's not what it's designed to do. And I guess, like, for me, one of the things I've really been thinking about is, like, you know, I think part of, like, liberal politics for, you know, in this country is so much about being reasonable, you know, hewing to reason, like eschewing emotion. Meanwhile, the right wing is all consumed by emotional politics, right? It's like, frothing. And, you know, I don't like what they're frothing about. I don't like the way they froth. I don't think it's good, you know, good politics. But I do know how austere liberals often are. you know, think about like the Democratic Party or something, but even like mainstream, you know, liberal LGBT organizations that have, you know, rely on wealthy donors or whatever. And I just keep thinking like, you know, part of the problem is what's one good slogan, pro-trans slogan, you know, to get out on the streets and march for? It's not like, actually, you know, evidence-based scientific research shows that, like, yeah, that's fine to say in court, right? But it's like, I understand why cis people aren't out in the street marching on behalf of what? Psychiatry, psychiatrically supervised medical care that has a private insurance reimbursement scheme that's really expensive. Like, ew, I don't even like that. I don't want to fight for that. I hate that I have to defend the most harmful system, right, that exists for trans people. Anyways, I'm editorializing here. Let me stop. What I wanted to say, though, is like part of what I've really come to think is like, we need a passionate pro-trans politics that gets people right in their hearts, that motivates them in their bodies, that doesn't abandon all the important ideas we've been talking about, but that makes them feel the stakes and makes them feel what is really true, which is our bodies are on the line. This is not about the freedoms enumerated in the Constitution. This is about what, if anything, is genuine freedom in the world. Do you want the right to dispose of your own body as you see fit or not? Right. And so I guess like from that perspective, as somebody who's on the ground floor of some of these fights, I mean, what do you want people to know? Also, what do you want people to feel about this political moment? And in an affirmative sense, I think. Right. Like what do you think? Like what kinds of feelings do we need to be like cashing in on and doubling down on as a political movement if we want to not just defend trans people right now, but if we want to actually start winning what we genuinely want and need, and if we want to actually engage in solidarity?
I feel a little bit like, as someone who's like been sort of in the courts and in the legislatures, like my affirmative emotional state has been like ruptured, and I'm like, I don't know, what are you? But you know, I feel that deeply. Like, I agree that that is what we need, and I do think like fundamentally what's at stake is our like actual humanness, like the sort of like the flesh and consciousness of being able to exist in and connect with our bodies and our desire. And that is something that I want to believe other people feel strongly about. You know, like, don't you want to like connect with your body and your ability to connect with the bodies of others and like get in sort of in transformational exchange of all different sorts? And that I think is very much at stake in every single possible way. That's at stake in so far as like, will we be able to determine, you know, how we, you know, are identified by the government? Will we be able to determine whether we can get healthcare? Will we be able to make reproductive choices? Will we be able to make familial choices? Will divorce be lawful? You know, all of these things. Will we be able to have access to, you know, things like our government officials in voting or even in protest? Will our organizations be able to be free of government surveillance insofar as they can demand membership roles? Like, these are the things that are already happening. And so what's at stake is all of this together, and every sort of incursion is it part of a project to allow the incursions across the board. And I want people to sort of feel that. And I want them to understand that it's not just a legal fight, that there is a way where we all need to connect with our own central humanity in order to build that, you know, process. And that means sort of being honest with ourselves about what excites us, what grounds us, what is the thing that gets us moving. And I think everyone is really different in that regard. And so like tapping into an honest understanding and conversation with self is not something I think we think or see a lot. But I think is important because the stakes are extraordinarily high. 2024 could not be a scarier year. I think that I have had a lot of conversations with people who I consider to be incredibly smart, thoughtful people who say, frankly, horrifyingly misinformed things. Things that are really hard, you know, to stomach because you sort of understand, like, I am here right now really wrestling with the fact that I hate the Democratic Party. I hate Joe Biden. I really can't abide people saying there's no difference between Biden and Trump. Because at the end of the day, the presidency isn't a person, A. So it doesn't really matter. These are institutions. These are like very complex political institutions. And there are fundamental differences between the two versions of these institutions. And if people think that a Trump presidency does not lead to a level of incursions into their political organizing in places like New York and California, they are sorely mistaken. As someone who is watching what happens under attorneys general like Ken Paxton and others in these Republican states, I can tell you right now that it is not just, federalism won't protect us because there's not going to be, like, federal law always trumps state law. So, at the end of the day, your idea of abortion being legal in New York is gone. Your idea of your organization being able to organize in New York is gone. So that is, people need to get their heads around that. You can still decide to make all sorts of choices with voting and otherwise, but we can't lie to ourselves about the world that we would then be contending with. I think that's incredibly important that I think people need to be honest about. I think that the fights that we're having in terms of the substantive discourse around trans life and trans bodies is part of these structural conversations about what is the structure of government that we are going to be living under. And sort of how are we ushering in certain types of authoritarian regimes or not. And again, it's all a spectrum. It's a level of degree. But what is the degree to which all of our bodies are going to be surveilled and controlled by the government, and in what ways? I think that to get ourselves like out from under where we are, we do need to sort of abandon the law. We need to abandon the sanitized discourse that the law demands of us, the discourse of evidence-based medicine and psychiatric supervision and whatever the hell else. And I'll go and say those things in court. And it will be hard for me, but I understand my, sort of fragmented role. But that doesn't mean that that dominates our discourse. We need to be out demanding our full, free, embodied humanity and our desires, which are central to that, which I think are one of the things that scare people the most.
Damn.
I mean, woo! I'm listeners, can you hear the smack just like coming out of all of our ears right now? Woo! Just want to co-sign all of that. I think that's actually, it's impossible to wrap up a conversation like this in part because like the point is, it's not over. Right. We are in the middle of something. I don't know. We don't know when it's going to end, but things are live. Things are fraught. Things are intense. But one thing I want to say, Chase, is thank you for your clarity and honesty and your stress on honesty. I actually think that was not the theme I was necessarily anticipating coming away from this conversation with, but it's been really meaningful to me. And I hope it's something that all of us can really try, not just think about, but actually tap into, taking into consideration a lot of the really important points and information that you're able to share with us about where things are and where things are going. I'm just really grateful for your time and for your vision and for your passion, but also for your hard work. So, Chase, thank you so, so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you. It was very liberating. So,
yeah.
All right, that is the show for this week. Please send us feedback and topic ideas at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook and X at Slate Outward. Also, keep sending those advice questions. We're getting more and more. We're really excited to do another one of those shows, so send those advice questions our way. Just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Working, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more about that, you can go to slate.com/outwardplus. Our show was produced by the fantastic Palace Shaw. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends all about it, and rate and review the show so others can find us. Until next week, stay gay, everybody.